alcoholic. Pretty big crowd for a Thursday night, man. That's pretty good. Larry's a great host. I got lost at the airport, and he found me. You know, I realized I'd never flown into the Las Vegas airport. And I said, went out where it says, you know, what does it say? The street. You know, so I went out to the street, and there was nothing but taxis there. And he had to drive around for a while to get me, so he hung in there. We talked a lot. We developed a relationship over that. And so I'm grateful. It's good to be live, isn't it? It's good to be live. Yeah. This is a real super spreader event here, boy. I hope I don't die. You know? We are hard to kill, though. Yeah. They keep trying. Right, Butch? There's another guy here that got a liver transplant, man. Anybody got any liver transplants here? Look, there's some hands. We should have our own meeting. So it says to tell my story. I got sober March the 27th, 1985. 37 years. I am very impressed by that. I think that's genuinely impressive. That's a long time. And I drank and used for 22, 23 years. So I've been sober a lot longer than I drank. So the sober story is a lot more interesting. I remember all of it pretty much, you know. As I get older, some of that's beginning to fade, though, too, you know. And so I really like talking about what happened when I walked in here. But I got to tell a little bit of this story. But, you know, Sandy Beach used to say, you know, there's my story and then there's what really happened. You know, so it's all kind of vague. But I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I rarely went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight, but I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains wrapped around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. My biker nickname was Horny. Just absorb that. I have it tattooed here on my arm. And it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-Y, Horney, with an exclamation mark for emphasis. That's pretty much all you need to know about me, isn't it? I kind of tell you, you can just extrapolate from there, you know. I was a fun guy, and you know, at 17 years old, I was a bad drunk in high school. I had a big jacket and a slouch and a sneer and a foul mouth and a bad attitude, and I carried a gun. And I'm from the mean streets of Palos Verdes. There's no gangs in Palos Verdes. Nobody was looking for me. I was a gang of one. And I met her, and she lived up in Oregon, and it was the 60s. Right? Remember the 60s? You know, I remember a lot of it. And so we went up through San Francisco. I was in San Francisco during the Summer of Love in Golden Gate Park. I'm really sorry I missed it. And we went up to Oregon to grow our own. And we had a couple of kids, got married, had a couple of kids. And I was ending up running with an outlaw motorcycle gang and sticking needles in my arm and drinking like a fish and not coming home to that family with those two little kids. And it was awful. It was awful. Short party. Huh? We all talk about how when we were growing up, we had this feeling of separation or we didn't feel part of, and then we drank and there was this unifying experience. And so I think the whole idea was to get out of the house and go have some fun, wasn't it? It was about the party, wasn't it? It was for me. It was about the party, about having fun. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. I'm having sex, menage a uno. There's like no one else in the room. You know? What the hell happened to the party? What happened to the party? Next time somebody walks into one of your meetings and just says, well, I'm just a party kind of guy, ask him how many other people were at the party that you just left. You know? So at 22, mental institution. Mental institution I was in was in the Oregon's, it was in Salem, Oregon. It's the Oregon State Mental Hospital. It's right across from the penitentiary. So you know where you're coming from or going to. And it was the mental institution that Ken Kesey worked on when he wrote Cuckoo's Nest. They filmed that movie on the ward I was on there. So next time you see that movie, think of me. Now, I'm not bragging. It's just all I got. Some people went to college, you know. This is the high point of the Drunkalogue. Now, some years ago, I spoke at a conference there in Salem. It's a beautiful little town. And I'm driving around trying to find the Nut House and visit my alma mater. And I end up at the speaker dinner for the committee and the speakers, and there's this long-haired hippie guy that came up from California about the same time I did and stayed there. And I told him, I said, I used to be in the mental institution here, and he says, I work there. I said, well, of course you do. You know, where else would you work? And I'm still friends with that guy. And so he took me there, he called them, and he said, I've got a dignitary from the South showing around, and we found my ward and had a picture taken there. And a couple years after that, I was speaking in Portland, and some guys from Salem came up there, and they brought me a gift. And that's one of my favorite possessions. It's a T-shirt that says, Oregon State Hospital Alumni. So after that, I mean, it was awful. There was a lot of violence, and it was really scary. And State of Oregon thought I should leave. And I came back down to Los Angeles, and my sober dad, who got sober in 1954, so on top of all my other problems, I got raised in an AA house. I don't recommend it. There's nothing worse than having two people with clear eyes who know exactly what's going on in your head, you know? But he let me sleep in his garage, and he gave me a job in his little machine shop in El Segundo. And I tried to clean up my act. And 15 years after the mental institution, I lived in the house with a second wife and a second set of two kids. My daughter was 3 years old and my son was 4 months old, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. We don't know that, do we? We don't know that we're disconnected. Silkworth knew that. Silkworth says, in the doctor's opinion, they lose touch with all things human. What an interesting statement to make, observing us. But I'm not capable of connecting to you, and I don't know that. I have no compassion. I never gained it, so I don't know that there's anything missing. And I lived in the house with these people, and one night, one of those nights I'm up all night, like we do, all alone in the living room, and there's nothing worse than when the sun comes up. Remember that? Nothing. I don't think there's very few things more depressing than that, because I don't want the sun to come up. I'm a vampire. I know it's going to be another miserable day in a long, long line of miserable days. The party is long. Nobody's coming to my house knocking on my door saying, can Billy come out and play? You know, and I was up all night. My little daughter gets up, and she was really happy to see that Daddy was up, so she runs out, jumps up in my lap, and it just broke my heart. Sometimes kids can cut through it, you know. It just broke my heart. And so like any good gangster, I called my mom. This is a woman that had been in Al-Anon for 30 years by that time. They are organized and prepared and focused. She got there inside of a half hour before I took the nap and changed my mind. Wouldn't want to rush into anything. And they checked me into a place in Costa Mesa, California called Starting Point. I spent 35 days in there. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. It was a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, "I am not a counselor." Because evidently there was some confusion about that. Then they let me out. They just let us out, don't they? Like we're okay. You know? Go forth, multiply. You know? And where do we end up when they let us out? The world's aftercare program, Alcoholics Anonymous. We are the counselors, aren't we? Truly, the inmates are running the asylum here. You stop and think about this. I've been married 3 times. I've been to a lockdown mental institution with barbed wire on top of the fence 2 times. I went back for a follow-up. I kind of liked it. And people ask me for relationship advice. I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. You know, they're in AA, you know. So 2 things happened to me when I walked into AA that are just pure luck. And I think the first one's the most important one. The longer I'm sober, this is the most important one. I just liked it. Not everybody's story. I walked into the Hermosa Beach Alano Club on a Friday night, the day I got out of the whatever that drying out place. The spin dry, as they used to call them back then, you know. You know, I was part of that generation that got sober incorrectly. And fortunately, I was just arrogant enough to argue for my position. But I walked into this club, and all the Harleys were parked out front, which I wasn't expecting that. This was not the meetings I remember going to in the 50s with my parents, right? The Harleys were all there. And who knew that an AA meeting on a summer night in Hermosa Beach would be full? Why would it be full? And this was a Friday night. The meeting was called the Gong Show. A lot of people said it wasn't really an AA meeting. I went to it for 20 years, you know. And they were laughing there. Nicknames were flying around the room. Their friends would get up at the podium to share, and they'd start hooting and hollering. One guy just got down off the podium. He couldn't get anything out because everybody was hooting. Everybody was dressed up trying to hook up on a Friday night down at the Alano Club, right? And I stood in the back of the room because there were no chairs. It was full. And I didn't feel part of because I wasn't. I didn't know anybody. But I started laughing. I heard the music right away. I got the joke where we laugh at the tragedies and we cry at the successes. And I got that. Could I define it like that? No. But I left there that night and drove home and I thought, you know, this may not be so bad. This is all the partiers that lived. Right? This is where they are. And there was a sense about that. And I literally went back the next night just to find out what the hell was going on there. And I've been doing that ever since. I've never lost that. I'm an old hippie from the 60s, and weird has always attracted me. And to this day, I find you all deliciously strange. Right? It's a never-ending font of weirdness, you know, and I love it. I just love it. Second thing that happened is I'm banging around for a couple of weeks, and all of you talk about, at least around where I'm from, talk about you got to get a sponsor. And the recovery place is a pretty straight-ahead place. So you got to get a sponsor. We want to know his name. Call us back, you know. So I saw this guy. He looked like he knew everybody, which he probably did. He was 6 years sober, and he was all enthusiastic, and he was there everywhere I went. I guess that's why I asked him. And I walked up to him, and I said, "Will you help me?" So we talk a lot about what a bottom is, even a bottom in sobriety, right? And I think what it is, it's the collapse of the alibi system. The ego just collapses for a while, and it comes back. But there's a window where new information can come in. And I'm not as defiant, I'm not as argumentative, I'm not, you know, just a little bit, just enough. And what he said to me that night, he said several hurtful things, but one of the things that he said was, go home and read the doctor's opinion, make notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't, be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock, and we'll discuss it. And I just did that. I didn't argue with him. I didn't, you know, I'm sure we had some discussion, but, you know, it was a hazy memory. But I remember going home and reading that. I think I told him we'd already read that in the hospital. We could just move on to level two. Right? And he says, no, you're on the street now. Just do this. And we'll talk about it. And so I did my assignment, and I showed up at this stranger's house. I'm sure I didn't even know his last name. Thursday at 5 o'clock, and he did a real intimate thing with me. He let me into his place, and we sat in his living room, just the two of us. No one else was around. And he didn't trust me that I'd read it, and he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. And I had made some notes because there were some incorrect things in there, and I, you know, wanted to discuss it, have a little debate, and we did. We talked, you know, we talked about stuff, right? I didn't know at the time it was an uncomfortable situation. That's why I was uncomfortable, because it was very intimate. It was just him and I. No one else was looking. And we talked. We talked. And each week I went to his house and we read another chapter in the book. And he took me into Alcoholics Anonymous. He took out a meeting directory and he circled some meetings, one of which was his home group, the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, that I've been going to now for 37 years because I'm afraid not to. And through all the incarnations of that meeting, all these years, people cycle in and cycle out. They do it incorrect for a while, and then you work on correcting them, and you create chaos, and then it corrects itself, and you just don't leave. I told him one time, I said, I'm sick of this meeting, I'm leaving. He told me, you can't leave because I'm staying, so you got to stay. And then about 2 months later, he comes to me, he goes, I've had it, I'm leaving. Oh, I said, no, man, you can't go, you know. And all the assholes that were in that meeting, they're all gone. I'm still there, you know. There's something good about not running away, huh? I mean, is there a group conscience or isn't there? We were having a big argument one time, and we had a meeting over at my house about what we were going to do, a group inventory. And after everybody left, it was very contentious. And after everybody left, I said to my wife, you know, if they don't do this, I'm done. That's it. This is the right thing to do. And if they don't do it, I'm out of here. Right? And she looked at me and she said, she's sober a long time. She says, well, you profess to believe in this stuff. I said, what? She said, well, the group conscience and all that. I hear you talking. You say you believe in it. I go, well, I do. That's what I'm trying to get to happen here. And she says, well, just wait till I finish. Don't move ahead of the story. And she says to me, she says, well, why don't you just place it before the group and let them decide? And if they don't go the way you want it, don't take your ball and go home. I thought that was indignant, you know. I think that's when you're supposed to smack him or something, aren't you? You know, I'm afraid of her, you know. So, where was I? So each week we read it, and at 6 months sober, I did an inventory. And I had one of those experiences that we have here that we try to explain. Some people say it's God. Some people say it's a coincidence. Some, you know, we have different, because we get hung up in the concept of what it is. But here in AA, we don't have to worry too much about concepts because we actually experience it. And then you can label it with whatever makes you feel comfortable. But the experience is hard to deny. And I had an experience after that fifth step. I went home and I realized that the guy who walked through that front door 6 months before wasn't the same guy as who walked in it today. And I said to myself, I think out loud, I said, my God, it's going to be like this now. The old life, whatever that was, seems to be over. And on top of that, I was 6 months sober. I hadn't been 6 months sober since I was 14 or 15 years old. That's a shock to the system. Remember that? You know, everything's weird, isn't it? Sober is weird. There's no medication. Everything's brand new. All the relationships, everything. So some years ago, I was with this pretty big-time Indian guru, and I was really impressed to be with this guy. I was very impressed. A friend of mine was attached to him, and we went to hear him speak, and we're on our little spiritual journey trying to find out what's cool. And I'm a hippie, so Ram Dass and be here, you know, all that stuff is cool. It was fun, and he was still around, and I got to meet him and sit with him. And so we're with this Indian guru, right, and we're sitting in the back of the room, and there's the three of us. And I'm talking away like I do, and he starts laughing at me, and he's laughing at me. I go, what are you laughing at? He says, well, I just love you alcoholics and drug addicts. And I said, why is that? He says, well, the rest of them out there are trying to get awakened. You're just trying to figure out what the hell happened. You know? Like, what the hell happened? What are we doing here? You know, how come we're not drinking? I mean, isn't it true we are people who normally would not mix? And we're mixing. You know, isn't that odd? I think the rest of the journey is trying to figure out what the hell happened. What's my purpose? There must be a purpose, don't you think? I think there is. You know, I think I've found my purpose, I think. You know, I started making amends. At a year sober, I started sponsoring people. What a journey. And I sponsor people today the same way. Now I'm doing it on Zoom. If I have to read War Fever Ran High in that New England town one more goddamn time, man, you know, whether you die by a musket or by pot. No, it's not pot, you know. You know what that poem really means? You know what happened to that guy? That poem is not telling you not to drink, because I've been there, and the little local AA, they love to explain what it really means. He drank small beer. Small beer is not fully fermented. And it was on a hot day, and he couldn't wait, and he drank it, and it swelled up in him, and he died. So the rest of the poem says, drink strong or not at all. And strong beer is fully fermented. So it's telling you how to drink correctly. Explain that to your next newcomer. You know? So it says in our book, in that little passage that my guy read, that the only thing that's going to save us, the only thing that's going to keep us sober, the only thing that's going to give us a life with some purpose, maybe some relationships with intimacy, is the maintenance of a spiritual condition. So evidently I need to get a spiritual condition so I can maintain it. And I didn't have one. So the first job is to try to get one of those. It also says in there that we're going to rest on these things called laurels. And what a laurel is a past achievement. I didn't have any of those. So I need to get some laurels so I can rest on them and find out why that's not a good thing. Right? So we got to start. There's a lot of work here, you know. It's going to take a while. And I started thinking about this spiritual condition thing, right? You know, there's a program in AA. There's only one. There aren't many. There's only one. We all know what it is. Even if we're not doing it, we know what it is. It's the 12 steps. And they keep telling us that over and over. They read chapter 5 every time, you know. And But we each have our own experience with it, don't we? Each one of us has our own experience. And I think what it's designed to do, and he's very clear about that in the book and in a lot of other writings and a lot of letters, is to bring about this some kind of spiritual awakening, to develop a condition, a spiritual condition, to live life on some kind of a spiritual or fourth dimension basis. My sponsor loves to say, he says, all my problems are in the third dimension and the solution to all of them is in the fourth. Right? I think that's probably true. So what is the spiritual condition made of? Well, the very first thing this guy wanted to know from me when I went to his house Thursday at 5 o'clock is whether I thought I was powerless over drugs and alcohol. Now, for me, that was an easy admission. I was very sick physically. I was quite sick. I was in trouble. And as it turned out, I was a lot sicker than I thought I was. And it almost killed me. 30 years sober, I almost died behind it. And so I could cop to that. But 37 years later, powerless has a much bigger meaning to me today. I think it's everything. And they didn't want to tell us that up front so we would run screaming down the street, you know. But I think it's everything. I think I literally have no control over anything at all. And I don't think I need any. I don't think lack of power is my dilemma. My dilemma is I think I have power and I keep trying to use it. And it creates havoc in my life. Self-reliance fails me. I have no faith and I crash and burn. And they don't tell you about the third surrender, the fourth one, and the fifth one, you know, but there's many coming. I talk to you incessantly about how if you were a little bit different, the two of us would be a hell of a lot happier. And you absolutely insist upon living your own life, and it pisses me off at my core. Right? I've lost complete control over the geopolitical situation in the world. Look at it. You know, doesn't matter which side you're on. But over 2 years ago, I shut off the news. I couldn't handle it. I was not emotionally stable enough to handle it. And I don't live in that world, do you? I don't live in that world. I'm powerless over all of that. They never once, nobody from Washington has ever called me and asked me what I thought about this situation. You know? And I get all cranked up and I don't want to live there. And I feel better. It took me a while to detox and I had several slips. You know? But I'm out of the game. I'm powerless over everything. I don't think there's anything I have any power, nor do I need any. Something else is running the show. Second step, right? It's a logical thought progression, isn't it? Because it seems to be just unfolding all the time. It seems to be happening. Everything seems to be running. When I focus on my breath, when I meditate, I realize I am being breathed. I'm not thinking about it. It's just sort of happening. And everything seems to unfold. Some people will tell you that you have to believe in God to do AA. No, you don't. All you really need to know is it's not you. Yeah. Wilson talked about this incessantly. Open-mindedness, right? It's not me. It's not me. That's all I need to know. And if I keep following it, I will have a series of experiences that will make me stop and think, and I'll start reading books, and I'll start looking for something. You know, that's our human nature. Is we want to understand. God, you wouldn't want to pick the wrong God. Wouldn't that be awful? You know? What if you died and realized, oh, hell, it was the wrong guy? You know? Then the third step comes around. And it's interesting. It says that I'm going to make a decision to turn my life and will over to clearly what already has it anyway. I think it was nice of them to lead me to believe that I actually have some say in the matter. Well, I've been withholding myself from the totality of all things long enough. I'm going to acquiesce now and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. Where's my trophy? And we have these windy discussions about what is God's will. My little ego that presented itself at 2.5 years old, like all of us, it loves the idea of us having a battle of wills with the power that drives the entire universe. How is that even possible, right? Chuck Chamberlain used to draw the circle with the stick man outside. After a while, you realize there's no circle. There's nothing to be, I can't possibly be separate from nature. There's no morality in nature. Things just are. We add the morality. We say the lion shouldn't eat the lamb. Well, good luck. You know? Well, then we create a fantasy land that someday there will be a space that will end up where the lion will lay down with the lamb. Because we have so much trouble with the immorality of nature. Now, if that happens, I think that lamb's going to be nervous for eternity. Because it's the nature of the lion to eat the lamb. There's no morality in it. And I struggle with all that. What is God's will? God's will is what's happening right now. What else could it possibly be? And I don't like what's happening right now. I'm looking for an alternative. And I suffer. I suffer. We talk a lot in AA about acceptance. My take on that is if I really realize how powerless I am, acceptance just happens. So it's a power thing, isn't it? I'm unaccepting. It should be different. I live my life in such a way that evidently what I believe is that things outside myself should be different in order for me to be okay. And that just doesn't happen, and I suffer. So then we get to the inventory. What life and will is the third step talking about? It's the inventory, isn't it? The end result of living a life with seeming power, resentment, fear, and broken sexual relationships. That's what I bring to you. That's what I have. This is my life. This is who I am. These three things is who I am. And I share it with this strange guy that I just met, this God that I don't believe in, and me. Maybe for the first time in my life. And what's the lesson in the inventory? It's the second pillar of spiritual condition. We got powerlessness, but the second one is I have to stop blaming other people and institutions for my problems. High school is over. It's time for little Bill to grow up and take responsibility for his own life. Back to the doctor's opinion. The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. How do we pull that off? It's someone else's fault. We can't take responsibility. We can't rationalize or justify our behavior, so we blame it on someone else. My first inventory was the entire federal government, and specifically the Department of Motor Vehicles. Who are they to tell me whether I can drive or not? It's going to take a while to stop the blaming. It's really ingrained in me. But if I surround myself with some fairly healthy people in AA, they will help me stop. We will help each other. You find your peer group, right? You find your peer group. Because AA really happens. Back in my day, it was in Denny's at 2 o'clock in the morning when you could still smoke. And you drink coffee and eat banana splits and smoke and talk about that weird meeting you were just at the Alano Club, What'd your sponsor tell you? Oh, he's an asshole. And, that's where AA really happens. That's where it really happens. The fourth column of the resentment list is essentially our defects of character, isn't it? Because what we're looking for, what are my faults and mistakes? That's what we're looking for. So you can make a list of them, but now that you're going to try to stop the blaming and you're starting to get, maybe you're powerless, they will come and visit you with alarming regularity. Because there's no more medication now. They just show up. I've had many, many incidences where I say something to somebody and walk away and thought to myself, oh, I did it again. I was 7, 8 years sober. I'm coaching a bunch of 9-year-olds in soccer, included my kids. And they were getting beat at halftime by 5-0 or something. And I gave them a lecture on how you have to have personal pride. You need to go out there and start knocking people over. You can't just let them crush you like this, right? So they will go back out there and they scored another couple of goals against us. And I just left, walked off the field. I had parked my Harley because I'm a badass in the basketball courts. And I jumped on my motorcycle, burned rubber through the basketball course and just drove off. And then I ran out of gas. It's hard to look cool with your big leather jacket and your helmet walking down the street. Jay remembers this. It's a true story. And I walked back to my house, and I called my sponsor and told him what happened. And he said, Bill, it's children's sports. And I actually said to him, you don't understand. This is critical. I got escorted off a soccer field for going after the referee one time. When you got to walk back out there and apologize to everybody, including your own children, you won't do that again. And so then we get to 8 and 9, right? And these people that I hate, that I'm angry at, that I'm blaming for, you want me to make amends to them in order to rid myself of the resentments. I am not going to do that. That makes no sense to me. It's scary. This is big time stuff now. But I do it. I do it. And when I go to somebody that I don't ever want to see again, and I look them right in the eye and I say the words that need to be said, pay back the money, whatever it is, when I turn and walk away from that experience, I am changed right then and there. The action of doing that will change you as a person. It's a cathartic experience. I'm changed. Because the ninth step is where the transformation really begins. Because this whole thing is about transformation. Back to the spiritual condition, right? What is that? What is a psychic change? Isn't that a change in the way we perceive the world around us? How do you get there? This thing actually works. This actually happens. It isn't very rapid, though. You know, it takes 37 years. And it's still happening. It's still happening. It's still happening. It doesn't ever stop. 1 through 9 is about 10% of the program. It's not the work. It's Sober 101. It's the first semester. And what's the lesson in the 9th step is the third pillar of spiritual condition. Nothing was ever personal. People are just doing what they do, and I happen to be in the blast radius of their behavior. And sometimes you're in the blast radius of my behavior. I'm not focused on you. You're just the next victim in line. None of it was ever personal. And the amends process will bring about this awareness. I hated my father. He didn't like me much either. And I was an awful kid. I was a spawn of Satan. I was a bad kid. And I knew I had to make amends to him. And I didn't want to do it. It was scary. Because when you do that, you lose. You lose. And I'm keeping score. You know, you ever hated somebody really good and then you forget to hate him on a certain day? So you got to hate him extra the next day to make up for the day you missed? Yeah. I made amends to him and I had one of those experiences. I got in my car and I started sobbing and I couldn't stop. And it was like something reached in and pulled that rage out of me. I've suffered from rage most of my life. It's pretty much gone now. I just get pissy. My wife complains about me being pissy, like giving her that look and stuff, you know, when you're pissy. And I keep telling her, hey, this is an improvement. You know. So the real work in AA is 10, 11, and 12, right? It's 90% of the program to me. That's where the work really is. The 10th step is the fourth pillar of spiritual condition. Self-awareness is compared to self-obsession, where you develop the skill of the watcher, the ability to watch yourself move through life, like an observer. And in meditation, you can watch yourself think. You can focus on your breath, and the little ego doesn't like being in the present moment. There's nothing for it to do. It wants to be in the future or in the past where it can work on stuff. So it wanders away from the breath, and you notice it has wandered away. And you gently bring it back to the breath. This is a game-changing experience. This changes the entire game. Evidently, I am not my thinking mind. If I was, I couldn't catch it. I think that's utterly fascinating. There seems to be another consciousness within me that's able to watch the egoic mind operate. I can watch it. Now, the other day, I walk a lot. The other day, I'm walking down the street, and it comes up with this creepy thing I did when I was 9 years old. And I stopped in the middle of the street, and I said, really? We're going to think about this. Really? What am I supposed to do with it? I really appreciate the input. Thanks so much for sharing. But I'm just going to move on with my day now. And I just looked at the street in front of me, because that's where I am. I'm not 9 years old anymore. You know, whatever memory I have of that may not even be what happened. I mean, what's the use of thinking about that? Now, logically, we can all understand this. But practically, what do we do about it? I don't have to go where this thing wants to take me. Now, sometimes I do. But there is an option. In meditation, the present moment has a feel and a texture to it. And if you're there often enough, you understand what it feels like to be in that present moment, to be right here, right now. Like one of the things in meditation, some people be meditating, they'll say a car drove by and disturbed them, or a leaf blower, you know, wrecked my meditation. Look at it like this. The sound, whatever that sound is in the same space you're in. There's no separation between you and the sound. But if you reject it, now there's a subject and an object. That's a separate reality. Now the leaf blower is evil, and it needs to die. Right? Don't you see that throughout the world? In the present moment, none of that exists. All there is that. And there is comfort in that. So during the course of a day, I recognize when I'm not in that present moment, and I can return to it. I don't have to go lock myself in a room somewhere. I can just stop. I'm just sitting right here in front of my computer doing this. Now, some guy calls me, and if I'm talking to him on the phone, am I playing a game on the computer while I'm talking to him? Sometimes. Yeah. But if I'm paying attention, I don't do that. I want to be right where I am, right here, right now. That's self-awareness. Now, self-awareness without humor is depression, right? Because there comes a time in this process where you stand there and you go, oh my God, it's me. It was never them. It's me. That is not a happy place, right? What do you do with that? Because you're so used to blaming them. You're so used to taking sides. You're so used to keeping score. It's kind of hard to break it. You know? My head is not out to get me. It's not about stopping it from thinking. It's not about crushing the ego. We all have one. It needs me for transportation. It doesn't want me to die. It just takes the past and projects it into the future over and over and over again. It's the same thing that told you that you weren't good enough when you were a kid. We all talk about this thing about, some people will call it alcoholic thinking. Like there's this thing called alcoholic thinking, right? I think what we suffer from is emotional immaturity, and we just like to think it was a little deeper and more profound, you know? I mean, Tebow called us King Baby. Isn't that true? Isn't that in your own story? Can't you look back if you've been sober a while when you just behaved like a teenager? Like when you come to me and complain about your boss, I immediately don't believe you. I figure it's your fault. You know? I mean, it may be true. Maybe the guy is an asshole, but you know, you've done something. You know, because that was always true for me. You know, it's always true for me. You ever had somebody stand in front of you? Maybe you've been sober a while, and they stand right in front of you, usually your partner, and she or he looks at you and says, "You are not emotionally available for me." Nod your heads. You know, yeah. Did you know what they meant by that? Because when it happened to me, I said to her, "What are you talking about? I'm standing right here. And I don't get it, right? I don't know that I'm not connected to you, right? But you can feel it from me." You know what they mean by that when they say that? Is that I've got something that they want and I'm withholding it. And the truth is worse. I don't have it. It's worse than that. I don't know that I don't have it. You've convinced me that I've got it and I'm helping you look for it. And this dance will go on forever, right? And if all I do is go to 875,000 meetings, nothing will change. Nothing, right? The final pillar of spiritual condition is the one that's missing, I believe, from most all of us. Compassion. What she was asking me for. She feels not connected to me. I don't understand it. But I lack compassion, and I never developed it. Most of us started drinking in middle school, you know, or at least high school, when the heavy lessons are being handed out. We're hammered. I missed most of them. I'm 37. When I walked in here at 37 years old, I had the emotional development of a very disturbed and angry 16-year-old. This kid was not mature beyond his years, you know, not that kid, right? The kid with a problem, the kid that wanted to be a gangster in Palos Verdes, you know. What was that about? I mean, I think back on that, and that's just embarrassing. You know, I mean, what was going on with me? I don't know. But when I showed up here, that's who showed up here. And I suffered from rage for a long time in AA. And at 10 years sober, it all collapsed. The Bill C. persona is a heavy load. First 10 years I was in AA, I was trying, working diligently to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. It's all I had to work with, right? I figured, well, I'm going to be here, I want to run it. You know, why not? And at 10 years sober, I had a mental and emotional collapse. And out of that came a big inventory. So I was the phony biker with the clip-on earring. I became the phony AA guru. Little healthier. People got helped. I did a lot of work. You know, much better than the phony biker. But the same guy. The same thing. And what's that look like? When you give a guy a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life, this is true, and he leaves the room, and I think to myself, that is really good shit. I should record that and hand it out to people, right? You know? Then the next thought is, maybe I should even do some of it. So I called my sponsor and I said, Jay, I think I'm a hypocrite. He goes, no, Bill, it's worse. You're a liar. You know? Yeah. Whatever prejudice you have will walk across the room and ask you for help. Right? And the way I was raised in AA, you just always say yes. I mean, the most spiritual thing you'll hear in Alcoholics Anonymous is get in the car. Right? Where are you going? What do you care? Get in the car. You know? So whatever prejudice you have, it'll walk across the room and ask you for help. And this guy walked across the room and he asked me for help. He said, I think I should tell you that I'm gay. I said, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? And he says, no. He says, I got the gay thing down pretty good. But alcoholism's kicking my ass. I remember standing in the middle of the floor looking at that guy going, this is going to be really interesting. You know, and when the third or fourth gay man asked me to sponsor him, I asked Jay, what's this about? What am I getting? He says, because it doesn't bother you. And I said, how do they know that? He just laughed and walked away. How do we know? Who knows? You know, who knows what this is about? But God, my life has gotten so much larger since I quit trying to run it. All the people, all of you that entered into my life. When I was dying from liver disease and I was in that hospital, all of you were there making inappropriate comments. Because that's what you do. And you bring light into a dark room. And when you're in the liver department at Cedars-Sinai, they never once asked me who those people are. They know you. You know? It's the liver department. You know? You're only supposed to have three in the room, right? So there's eight of you in there. The nurse would come in and just push people out of the way. You know, it was just, what's happened to me now, you invited me into your life and I went. I invited you into my life and you came in with all of your weirdness, all of your humor, all of your problems, and all of your love, right? I used to hear people in AA say it's all about the love, and I thought, how stupid is that? Say some candy, sugary thing like that, and I can tell you today, it's all about the love. That's what it's about. We just don't get it. You know, it takes a while to really get it. You ever been in a position where you're being loved on and you felt yourself being resistant to it? When I was in the hospital, people were coming and loving on me. And I could I have enough awareness where I could see myself like, well, it's not real. Oh, come on, Cleveland. Really? Isn't that interesting about us? That injured little boy inside, he's still there. He raises his head every once in a while, you know, but he doesn't have much of a voice anymore. I can tell you today, you can tell how spiritual you are if you're surrounded by people that love you. That love you. I am surrounded by people now that love me, that care about me, and they respect me. You know why? Because you have made me lovable. And when I got here, I just wasn't. You know? AA does a really good thing for us. It helps us laugh at who we think we are. Not who we are, but who we think we are. You will laugh at me when I'm trying to be that guy. And at 10 years sober, when the collapse happened and I did that big inventory, at that time I could not laugh at myself. Now I get it. You know, now I get it. There's Bill trying to control the city. Oh, there's Bill being the center of attention again. Isn't he happy? You know, it's kind of cute. You know, how do you learn to love yourself? Don't you have to accept yourself and all your ramifications? You know, I think that's how it works. I think my time is up, and I'd like to leave you with one final thought. They say here you got to give it away to keep it. No, you have to give it away to even get it. That's how you get it. Thank you so much.